important. Let me ask a question. What do you consider to be important things in life? What are some things you consider to be important?
Being kind.
Family? Being kind?
Health?
Food, says Jack. God, thank you. We are a church, so. Anything else? Your job?
Salvation,
absolutely. Family, relationships. You know, there's so many things which we consider to be important, and yet it's amazing how easy it is to not focus on those things, to not focus on what's really important, get distracted by other things. Take out your Bibles and let's have a look over in the book of Luke. In Luke chapter 9, and we'll pick up here in verse 37. It says, the next day when they came down from the mountain, a large crowd met him. A man in the crowd called out, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son, for he is my only child." A spirit seizes him and he suddenly screams. It throws him into convulsions that he foams at the mouth. It scarcely ever leaves him and it is destroying him. "I begged your disciples to drive it out, but they could not." "You unbelieving and perverse generation," Jesus replied, "how long shall I stay with you and put up with you? Bring your son here." Even while the boy was coming, the demon threw him to the ground in a convulsion. But Jesus rebuked the impure spirit, healed the boy, and gave him back to his father. And they were all amazed at the greatness of God. Jesus has just been up on top of the mountain along with Peter, James, and John, and they've just seen Jesus being transfigured. There is a display of his heavenly divine glory. They'd heard the voice of God saying, "This is my son, listen to him." Now they've come down the mountain. As they come down the mountain, they're faced with this, it seems like a crazy scene. Here's a man, and he's got his son, and his son is suffering. He's demon-possessed. He's been thrown into convulsions. He's foaming at the mouth. He's running around, and this man says, "Jesus, please help me. I spoke to your disciples." There were 9 of them left at the foot of the mountain. "So I spoke to your disciples, and they couldn't do anything." And Jesus then comes in and he takes control and he heals the boy. You know, it's only when you have some kind of catastrophe do you stop and really focus on what's really important. You ever been really sick? I mean, here, the description of this boy who's sick to the point where he's been thrown around, he's been seized by convulsions, he's foaming at the mouth. That's a scary thing. And more than that, for this man, it says, he's my only child. Now, when you have someone in your family who's ill, particularly those of us who are parents, when one of your children gets sick, you feel it. You feel just this sense of helplessness. Even I was away these last couple of days. We had a leadership retreat over in Oxford. And whilst I was away, Julie sent a message saying that Bella was sick again and had to be taken to hospital again. And, you know, I'm thinking, you feel for your pets. I almost said child. But you know, when our children were young and they got sick, I felt them. The very first day in the hospital after Sarah had been born, she was born. She'd been diagnosed with jaundice. They had to take blood from her, and I was holding her in my arms. And they pricked her heel to squeeze out some blood. And I was holding her, she was looking at me, all of a sudden she got stabbed, and then she looked at me like, "What have you done?" And I'm like, "It wasn't me." And there's blood. But I felt for her. I wanted to hit the nurse who took some blood. What? Get away from her. Leave her alone. Because I wanted to protect her. Why? Because I loved her. I cared for her. She was important to me. Here's this fella, and his son is in a bad way. And he comes to Jesus, and Jesus helps and deals with the situation. But you know, later on, the disciples come to Jesus, and it's, we don't see this in Luke's account, but you read it in Mark chapter 9, in Mark's account. They ask him, how comes we couldn't drive out this demon? And Jesus says, this kind can only come out by prayer, and some additions it adds by prayer and fasting. This whole idea of, you got to be close to God. In Matthew 17, he talks about, you know, you have so little faith. The only way we're going to grow in faith is if we grow in our walk with God. And you know, it's interesting because we can get so focused on different things throughout the day that we actually forget what's really important. We can get so focused that we jump out of bed in the morning, you dive into the shower, you get dressed, you dash out of the house so you can get to work on time. And it's amazing how often we can just forget to slow down enough to take some time with God. How are your Bible studies going? How are your quiet times? How are your prayer times? You know, we can get so caught up in the busyness of life, running around, taking care of this, that, and the other, and we forget what is really important. You know, Jesus came in, and he was able to deal with this situation. This situation, the disciples couldn't deal with it. It seemed like, well, this is hopeless. What can we do? But Jesus is able to take care of things. And you know, the closer we are to Jesus, then the more we're going to be able to cope with the various challenges and storms that come our way. And if we can stay close to God, it will make all the difference in the world. Many of us are faced with some challenges in life. Many of us are faced with different problems and particular difficulties. And it's easy to get overwhelmed. It's easy to feel like, who can help? But I'm here to tell you that Jesus can help. That God can fix things. And you know, if we stay close to God, it makes all the difference. Sometimes when we pray, God's answer is no. But by praying, God gives us the strength to go to work through and to go through the storms. But we have to be close to God. Let's look on. In verse 43, as we carry on, it says, and they were all amazed at the greatness of God. While everyone was marveling at all that Jesus did, he said to his disciples, listen carefully to what I'm about to tell you. The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. But they did not understand what this meant. It was hidden from them, so that they did not grasp it, and they were afraid to ask him about it. You know, earlier on in the chapter, in verse 21 and 22, Jesus had already told them that he was going to be handed over to the chief priests, to the elders of the people. He's going to be crucified. He was going to die. They were on their way to Jerusalem, where he was going to be facing his ultimate challenge. And a number of times on this journey, he actually tells them that I'm going to die. And he reminds them. And he uses this moment to remind them yet again. Notice this in verse 43. All the people are amazed at the greatness of God. Jesus has just done this incredible miracle. He's healed this sick child. And it says, while everyone was marveling at it, at all that Jesus did, that's when he turns to his disciples and says, I'm going to be handed over. And he's reminded them where he's going. Because it'd be so easy to be caught up in just the adulation of the moment. It'd be so easy to be caught up in all the just the recognition of the crowd. People are just, they're marveling at him. They're in awe of the power of God. And they're all crowding around thinking, this is fantastic. And Jesus turns to his disciples and says, I'm going to be handed over to my death. And he reminds them what is really going on. We can so easily get distracted by so many different things and forget why we're here. Jesus, he kept his focus. He knew why he was here. You know, in Isaiah 53, a prophecy about the coming Messiah, says, Lord, who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He grew up before him like a tender shoot and like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering, and familiar with pain, like one from whom people hide their faces. He was despised, and we held him in low esteem. You know, Jesus, the Bible tells us, he wasn't someone that had a particular majesty or beauty in his appearance that would attract people to him. And I think God did that deliberately. Now, the Bible doesn't tell us exactly what Jesus looked like, but we do know that there was nothing in his physical appearance that would attract people to him. He would have been just your average, ordinary individual. And here in this moment, when he's just healed this young boy, and people are crowding around and they're marveling at him, it'd be so easy to get caught up in this moment of, wow, people are being drawn to me, they're recognizing me. Because let's be honest, just the way we are as people, we like the idea of being attractive. We like the idea of people being drawn to us, whether it's for some physical reason or whatever. You know, for my birthday last week, Michael and Jolla gave me some aftershave for my birthday. I don't normally wear aftershave. And so I was at home and I opened this and I thought, this is really nice. It's obviously expensive stuff. It was, right? I said to my daughter, Hannah, she said, where did you get this from? I said, oh, yeah, Michael got this and Jolla got this for my birthday. But I don't wear aftershave. What should I do? She said, Dad, you should wear it. I said, what if I don't want to wear it? No, Dad, really, you should wear it. I said, what are you trying to say, Hannah? She said, no, just wear it, Dad, it'd be good, you know, people get dry. I said, why? She said, well, you know, it smells good. What if you're sharing your faith on the tube and there's a blind person there? They can be drawn to the aroma. She actually said those words. You can ask her. The Bible tells us Jesus said nothing in his appearance that would attract us to him. And here he is right now, he's in this moment where he's being surrounded by all his people. It'd be so easy to bask in that and to lose focus and forget, well, what are we really here for? Why are we here? I saw this on Facebook. If I had a dollar for every girl that found me unattractive, they would eventually find me attractive. You can just ask, you know, Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg. Or there was an interview I saw on TV. There's this old guy, this magician, Paul Daniels. You know, he's short, balding. His wife used to be his assistant. You know when they say these magicians that this is his beautiful assistant? Well, Debbie McGee, she was his beautiful assistant. She ended up marrying him. And in an interview, I think it was Caroline Ahern, asked Debbie McGee. She said, so, tell me, Debbie, what first attracted you to the millionaire Paul Daniels? You know, Jesus, he had all this crowd, and they were surrounding it, and they were marveling at him, and they were in awe of his crowd. And it's so easy for us to bask in that, because we want that. You know, we dress smartly. We want to make sure we get our hair done. We want to, make sure we wear the right clothes. I was at the beginning of the service as we're singing the songs, and I'm looking at some of the song leads over here, and we've got Diana and we've got Michelle, and they're both dancing to the music like this, and I'm thinking, wow, they're so very graceful. I dance like a pig on a hot tin roof, and I'm thinking, wouldn't it be nice to be able to move so gracefully like that? And because, you know, we like this idea of being attractive to others. And yet, that's not what Jesus was concerned about. We can get so distracted about things that really don't matter. What matters is, what is our real purpose? See, Jesus, he reminded his apostles, I'm going to die. I'm on my way to die for mankind. Why are we here? We're not here to look good. We're not here to do well in our jobs. We're not here to be famous. We are here to help seek and save the lost. That's why we, as disciples, are here. We've been given a mission. We We just went, some of the brothers from around the UK churches, we just went to this to Oxford for this staff retreat I mentioned. And this picture was taken last night, and you may not realize this, but the front row are made up of the seven oldest people in the room in descending age. So Tokes is the oldest, then Malcolm, then Charles, then Mohan, then Roger, then Tim, and then myself. And then we got all the other people behind, because we don't really care about them, because they're the young ones. And unfortunately, Paul was sick, so he couldn't make it. So Daniel came in his place, and Daniel was there because he's doing a one-year challenge. And I'm sitting over here on the end. And you know, it's interesting, because I remember when I first came to the church, I was one of the younger guys in the church. Now I'm one of the older ones. Whoa, amazing. But there I was, and I was one of the young ones, and I used to think to myself, wouldn't it be nice to be a little bit older so that I can have a little bit more responsibility? Because as the younger guy, I was 16, and everyone else was older, like 23, 24, I mean, so much older. But then they got to do things in church, but I kept getting overlooked because I was just the young guy. And now I'm the older guy, and I'd much rather be standing at the back with some of the younger guys now. But it's amazing how we can get so caught up in rankings. Where do I stand? Where do I fit in? How am I doing? And it becomes a distraction from what's really important. Look further in verse 46. It says, an argument started among the disciples as to which of them would be the greatest. Jesus, knowing their thoughts, took a little child and had him stand beside him. Then he said to them, whoever welcomes this little child in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me. For it is the one who is least among you all who is the greatest. You know, the disciples, they've just been told by Jesus that I'm about to be delivered into the hands of men. He's going to his death, and it says an argument started among them about who's the greatest of his disciples. It's almost like what he said just went away. It's like it's almost like he didn't even say it, because they get so caught up on who's most important. You know. Their thoughts were very much set on earthly things. Jesus has just received all this incredible attention from people. He's done amazing things. They've been with him for a short while, and they've seen some of the incredible things he does. You know, in Mark 7, when he's preaching the Sermon on the Mount, at the end it says, no one taught the way he did. You know, in John 7, when the priests sent temple guards to arrest him, and they came back without him, they said, why didn't you arrest him? They said, well, no one speaks the way he does. You know, he's just... And then the miracles he's performing, they're just incredible. And it's clear that Jesus is amazing. Jesus is someone special. You know, to be a follower of a rabbi in that time period was an incredible honor. For Jewish boys growing up, you know, they would be taught the Torah, they'd be taught the Jewish scriptures from a very young age. And then if a rabbi called them to follow him, then they would drop everything to follow, because it was considered to be the greatest honor possible. And it's one of the reasons why when Jesus is calling his disciples, there they are, mending their nets and going out fishing and doing various things, tax collecting. But when he calls them to follow, they leave everything to follow him, because that's an incredible honor. They would have been the ones who would have been overlooked by all the other rabbis, because it was only the brightest and the best who got called to be a follower of one of the great teachers. And so when Jesus called them to follow, they were like, let's do this. And they dropped everything to follow him. And they're following him, and now they're seeing not only is he a rabbi, but he's an awesome rabbi. I mean, one of the first miracles they did, he took them to a wedding, and they've run out of wine, and then he turns water into wine. How amazing is that? I read something else on Facebook recently. It was just a poster. It says Jesus walks into a bar and orders, he says, 12 waters, please. And then he winks at his disciples. You know that this guy is destined for greatness. I mean, here he is amazing. And so they're thinking to themselves, wow, where do we all fit in? Why? Because they're still thinking in earthly terms. They're still thinking in an earthly kingdom. Where do we fit in? And some people say that maybe this particular argument started because when Jesus went up on the mountaintop and he only took Peter, James and John. And they're the ones who, when they come down, they've seen him in all his glory. Now they're sharing with the other guys, you should have been there. It was amazing. And then they're arguing, well, just because you went doesn't mean you're best, you know. And then James and John, they get their mother involved to ask her, can we sit at your left and the right in the kingdom? And this is ridiculous. And it's amazing how we can so easily lose focus on what's really important. You know, last night at the staff retreat we had for the men, we ended the retreat by playing a series of games. And these games were based on this series called Minute to Win It. We have to do different activities in 60 seconds. And so we had two teams, and we just divided up the room. And then we had the two teams competing, and it came right down to a tiebreaker. We played, I think it was eight games, or we had four or six games, and we were equal points. We were level on points, four points each. And so we had a tiebreaker, and so then we're thinking, what should we do? Because you can't just leave it at a tie, because when you're with men, someone's got to be the winner and someone's got to be the loser. And so we had to have a tiebreaker. If it was women, it would be like, yeah, it's a draw, woohoo. You know that's true. But with the men, we have to figure out who is the dominant one. And so we're trying to decide, what should we do for a tiebreaker? And I was advocating, let's have an arm wrestling competition. Because we had Tokes on my side, and also Jack Legon was on my side. And I figured, hey, you know, let's have an arm wrestling. But that didn't go down well. And so we were going backwards and forwards. And I was like, well, let's have a push-up competition. Because I've been doing some push-ups recently, and, you know, let's do that. But that didn't go down well. In the end, they decided to repeat one of the games that we'd done before. And one of the games we'd done before was you have to, and you've seen this, we did this at our Christmas party a couple of years ago. We have a biscuit bounce on your forehead, and somehow by using the muscles in your face, you've got to work that, without using your hands, you've got to work that biscuit down into your mouth without it falling, and then you've got to eat that biscuit. And so so we were going to have this. And we'd already done that once before, and that had ended in a draw. And so we decided, let's repeat that particular game, and this time we'll just play to the first person who eats three biscuits, then that team wins. And yeah, because you can't stop at one. Three biscuits. Oh no, the calories. And so I was all for, okay, on my team, Mulligan had done it for us before. Now, Mulligan, he leads church in Belfast. He used to be in London. He used to lead the teens in London. And so he was used to playing all these games. And so I'm thinking of my strategy brain. Some would call it a lizard brain, but it's a strategy brain which I'm thinking, this, if we have Mulligan do it again, he's already done this before, he's experienced it, let's have him do this, because he was very good the first time around. And in fact, in the first time around, he actually finished ahead of the other guy, but because it was a minute and it was just whoever completed the task, he got points for it. So we would have won. I thought, no, let's just do Mulligan. But Mulligan was out of the room at the time. He was on a video call, because there was a sister getting baptized in the Belfast church. I'm like, forget the baptism, call him back in. It's a tiebreaker, we need this. And they're like, no, we'll just have someone who hasn't gone. Let's have Daniel Rowden, because he hasn't gone yet on our team. I'm like, no, let's get Mulligan. Call him, we need him. But in the end, they all thought a baptism was more important, so they had Daniel competing for our team, and he was competing against Charles Elikiu on the other team, and sad to say, Charles won. So our team, we were the losers, and they were the winners. But you know, it's funny, because As I was thinking about it afterwards, and I've been challenged on this once before. Once, maybe a few more times than that. About being too competitive. To the point where I think the first time, I've been challenged on this lots of times, but when I was married, when Julie and I first got married, the first time Julie challenged me on this was when I would be thrashing our kids at games when they were young. And I remember she pulled me aside and went, "Honey, just let them win one." "No! No! I can't let them win because they've got to learn that they've got to earn their victories." And last night I was thinking, you know, oh boy, there I was just advocating, let's have Mulligan coming in again because and Daniel hadn't competed in the end of the games yet, and I'm thinking, it doesn't matter, Mulligan. It's so easy. These guys were so competitive, and it's so easy to get distracted from what's really important. Jesus, he pulls in a little child, and he says, "You've got to become like a little child. You've got to be humble. Whoever's least in the kingdom is the greatest." And you know, what God calls us to is he calls us to humility. He calls us to be humble. You know, I really do appreciate Diana and the fact that she's going off to Zambia to serve for 3 months. For 3 months. And then she's coming back to the East after 3 months. And so... But I appreciate her heart to go and serve the poor. You know, honestly, when Paul described her as an education expert, she actually really is. That is her position in the borough for which she was working. She was head of her particular department in the school that she was in, and then she was promoted to take care, go into schools and help teach them best practices, and then she became a consultant, and they sent her all these different places. Because she's good at what she does, but she's leaving all that. And she was offered various jobs with lots of money, but she decided, no, I'm going to go unpaid to help support, set up this school in Zambia to help the poor and the needy. And, you know, that doesn't carry with it a lot of recognition. It's not like people from all over going, "Whoa, isn't this person..." Or, no, people don't know necessarily. But you know, that's what Jesus is talking about right here. Welcoming those little ones. Taking care of the children in this day and age, they were the lower echelons of society. They didn't have a voice. They were overlooked often. And yet Jesus held them up as, okay, this is what it means. You've got to take care of these people. The marginalized in society. But it's just having that kind of a heart, that humility. You know, today, I really want to encourage us to focus on what's important. To be close to God. When we're faced with challenges, it's only in our walk with God that's going to make the difference. Don't skimp on your quiet times. Don't neglect your Bible study, your prayer life. Make that a priority in your life. Remember why you're here. Jesus could have got so caught up in just the adulation of the crowd, but he didn't. He reminded his apostles, "Hey, I'm here to die." We also are called to follow him. The Bible says that we are called to take up our cross daily, that we are called to follow in his steps and to lay down our lives so others might be saved. That's why we are here. Let's remember that. And then finally, let's not get distracted about position. Let's not try to get so concerned about where do I stand in society? How am I doing? It's not important. Not in the grand scheme of things, it's not important. Because when we die, the only thing that's going to be important is, are you right with God? That's the only thing. And so I want to encourage us to be humble and recognize that the only person who matters is God. And we'll be pleasing to him if we follow his commands. You know,